Hi, and welcome to this week's Undisclosed Addendum. I'll be hosting this week to discuss episodes 1 and 2 of our series on Rocky Myers. In these first two episodes, we lay out the facts of the murder of Ludie Mae Tucker in Decatur, Alabama in 1991, as well as the initial suspect in that murder, who was Anthony Coolbreeze Ballantyne. In episode 2, we explained how the investigation turned from Ballantyne to Rocky Myers and raised some questions about the police investigation and whether Myers makes sense as a suspect. I'm joined this week by two guests. First, we have Colin Miller here, Associate Dean and Professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and one of our hosts of Undisclosed. Hey, Colin.
Hey, Susan. How are you?
Good. And we also have Sarah Amano here. Sarah Amano is the Chief Investigator for the Capital Habeas Unit for the Middle District of Alabama Federal Defender's Office. She's worked as an investigator at the Federal Defenders for over 15 years, and she's licensed by the state of Alabama as a clinical social worker. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Now, to start off with, can you tell me, what does it mean to be the chief investigator for the Capital Habeas Unit?
As the chief investigator, I am the chief over the other investigators who work in our Capital Habeas Unit. And so our Capital Habeas Unit represents individuals that are going through the appeal of their capital murder conviction and the sentence against them, a death sentence that's been against them. So those are the people we represent going through their appeals. All of them have been convicted in the state of Alabama, and their appeals will include them going through the state post-conviction appeal and then the federal appeal. So as an investigator, specifically working for the capital habeas cases, we start by, you know, reviewing the case when we get a case. It's a big case as far as like documents. So we get all of the court records, like from all the motions that were filed pre-trial, and then the entire trial transcript, and then all of the appeal record as it had already gone through its direct appeal and whatever stage it's in at the appeal. So we review, read all of that. I come up with an investigative plan to start beginning talking to witnesses, talking and deciding like what records we still would like to get that are missing from the files, and start working for our client. So I meet with the client, start to build rapport with our clients and also with their family and for any of the witnesses that we'll be talking to and, you know, interviewing and using as we go through their appeals.
So how do you get your clients? Are they assigned to you? Is it paid for by the clients themselves, or does the state pay for this?
They're indigent clients. And so as the Federal Defender's Office, we are funded to represent them through their federal appeals. We also, in my office, we have a nonprofit. It's the Alabama Post-Conviction Relief Project that assists with representing clients through their state post-conviction appeal. And so we get our cases typically from the court. So sometimes it can come from the Middle District, Southern District, Northern District of Alabama, where they ask us to take on a case as it's going through its federal appeals. We've also been asked, like, so there's an organization here, the Equal Justice Initiative, and they track cases in Alabama as people are going through their appeals, because in state post-conviction, clients aren't given an attorney to represent them. So they keep up with that to see who might need an attorney and who's, you know, needs to have somebody assigned to their cases. Sometimes Equal Justice Initiative will ask us to take on a case when they're having difficulties, which is typical, difficulties getting attorneys to represent clients as they're going through their appeals. We've also had federal judges ask us to assist outside counsel through the appeals, because we have resources here with experts and investigators. So we help out too on other cases.
And how'd you come to be involved in the Rocky Myers case?
In Rocky's situation, back in 2004, he had an attorney that was representing him through his state post-conviction appeal. And that attorney ended up dropping his case. So he had a filing that was due in court, and that attorney never filed the necessary petition in that court. So Rocky ended up getting a letter from the attorney general's office advising him that they were asking for an execution date for him, and that he dropped his appeals and he should try to see if he could find somebody to help him file a federal appeal. But at that point, he was already out of court. He was procedurally barred from really filing anything, but they sent him a letter. He ended up having a friend on the row who was represented by EJI. So that friend called EJI and asked them to help Rocky, because, I mean, Rocky couldn't even read the letter. He doesn't read well at all. So EJI then, we were a new unit. We had just opened about maybe a year earlier than that here at the Federal Defenders, and they thought it was a good case for us to take on as we were getting, you know, started in our unit. So they asked us to file a petition on his behalf, and we did that.
So he was notified by a letter he couldn't read that he was eligible for execution now?
Yes.
That seems reasonable. How many death row prisoners are there in Alabama right now?
I think it's around 185-ish, so there's a lot.
Yeah. And are they all at the same prison, or are they kept?
No, so most of them are kept at Holman Prison, which is in Atmore, Alabama. Some of them are kept at Donaldson Prison. There's only maybe 15, I think, there. It's typically for people that, you know, have to be separated from maybe their co-defendant that's also on death row, or some of the people who need like better mental health and stuff, because they seem to, for some whatever reason, they wouldn't say this, but there are like pretty mentally ill inmates on death row in Donaldson. And our female death row clients are kept at Tutwiler.
What is Rocky's status now? Is he still eligible for execution? Has he exhausted all of his appeals?
He has exhausted all of his appeals, yes. And so he is eligible for a date. And the only really chance for Rocky at this point would be if the governor, the state of Alabama governor, commuted his sentence to life without parole. But so that's it.
How common is that in Alabama? I'm guessing not very.
It's not common. Not at all. There's been one, and that was years ago.
Wow. So even though there's no more appeals and he has technically open or available, do you still represent him?
We represent him. So, for example, if, you know, we could file and have filed actually a successor Rule 32 petition. So meaning like there's laws that can change over time, obviously. And so with Rocky's case, because his case was a jury override, so the jury had recommended life without parole sentence to the judge, but then the judge overrode it and sentenced Rocky to death. Then a Supreme Court decision, it's a Hearst decision that talks about that's unconstitutional, and the state of Alabama actually has changed that practice. So as of last year, the governor signed into law that there can't be a judicial override on cases anymore. But for people like Rocky, who are already on death row because of a judicial override, they didn't make it retroactive. So it doesn't change what's happened to people in the past, even though the state actually agrees that it's unconstitutional because they signed a law for that. But it doesn't help Rocky and other folks that are already on death row.
Is there any chance the Heyman decision this morning would impact that?
So we don't work in federal court, but there is an attorney who took a case and has filed a successor Rule 32 petition on Rocky's behalf in the county. So certainly anything can be added, you know, to that, to add additional laws and additional information for them. Mm.
I'm a little embarrassed to admit that I have always been that person who has just like bottles and bottles and bottles of shampoo all over like their bathroom and bathtub and shower stall, because I always buy the promises. I buy the promises of the miracles that they are supposed to produce on your hair, and rarely does it happen. But here's the thing, it doesn't have to be that way anymore. What if there was just one shampoo that could actually do it all? Guess what, guys? I found it. It's called Function of Beauty. Function of Beauty addresses all of your hair concerns, not one. Now think about it. You know, when you go to buy a shampoo, you got to like look at, like, let's say there's one brand, but every one of their shampoos does something different. You've got one that volumizes. You've got one that makes your hair shiny. You've got one that detangles, one that nourishes. I mean, I want my hair to be shiny and volumized and nourished all at the same time. Why is it so complicated? Well, with Function of Beauty, you can choose up to 5 hair goals to add to your formulation. It is a custom-made shampoo to do exactly what you want it to do for your hair. It's amazing. Function of Beauty individually formulates every single bottle just for you based on your hair type, your hair goals, and your preferences. You also, and this is so cute, you get to select the color and fragrance, and I love pretty looking shampoos and pretty smelling shampoos, but you can also get dye-free and fragrance-free if that's how you want your shampoo. You can even name your formula. It's pretty cool. Their products are so personalized that your name is actually printed on the bottle. And they are vegan and cruelty-free. They have safe, natural ingredients. It's amazing. Function of Beauty never uses sulfates, parabens, mineral oils, or just anything that's harmful. Now, when I had my custom bottle made, this is what I wanted for my hair. I wanted it to be shiny. I wanted volume. I wanted to have some oil control because I kind of have oily hair. I wanted it to hydrate, and I wanted it to strengthen my hair because I tend to keep it tied up a lot, and that can cause some breakage. So we wanted some strong hair. Then I picked out the Perfection scent because I love the smell of pears. And yes, my hair smells amazing when I use this. And I wanted my shampoo to be a beautiful, summery teal color. And so that's my custom shampoo from Function of Beauty. That's exactly what it is made for and looks like and smells like. And well, you can get yours just like that too, or make your own. Now you can customize your own bottle because listeners will get 20% off their first custom formula. To get it, all you gotta do is go to functionofbeauty.com/undisclosed right now and take a very quick 2-minute hair profile quiz to design your 100% unique shampoo and conditioner formulas. By the way, guys, these are at a fraction of salon shampoos, okay? Once again, go to functionofbeauty.com/undisclosed right now and redeem 20% off your first order at functionofbeauty.com/undisclosed. Once again, that's functionofbeauty.com/undisclosed. UNDISCLOSED.
Now, Colin, we heard audio from you actually talking to Rocky last episode. How did that come about?
Yeah, and so Sarah and Casey, who is the attorney who is representing Rocky, were able to schedule a phone call between Rocky and myself. So we talked early last week and had a good conversation. As Sarah notes, he has some mental limitations. And as we'll discuss in episode 3, he has some physical issues that actually tie into what I believe is a pretty strong claim of innocence. But you know, he reminds me most of a case we presented earlier on the podcast, the Willie Vesey case. And Jules Epstein, his attorney at Temple, basically said the thing about Willie is he doesn't have an edge. He's not the type of person, when you talk to him, you get any real sense that he could be a physical threat to anyone or harm anyone. And that's kind of the same sense I got talking to Rocky. He seems like a really nice, empathetic guy who somehow, under a horrible set of circumstances, got implicated in this murder and, you know, is just really, really hopeful that he can get some type of relief. Not even necessarily being set free, but just taken off death row would mean so much to him and his family.
The arbitrariness of the death penalty is something that comes up time and again, and this seems like another example of it, even setting aside the hugely important question of innocence. This case does not seem like the kind that you'd expect the most severe punishment to be handed down in. Why would the death penalty apply to this case and not to other crimes that are, I mean, just more horrific and heinous in nature?
Yeah, and one interesting thing we didn't bring up in the podcast itself, maybe Sarah can comment on this too, is when they charged Anthony Coolbreeze Ballantyne in this murder, they did not charge it as a capital case. When they then later ended up charging Rocky Myers with this murder, they did charge it as a capital case. And I'm not sure there's any real explanation. Sarah, do you have any sense of why they changed that between Ballantyne and Rocky in this case?
I don't have any real sense. I don't have any facts or information about why they did that. I think that my opinion is just strictly my opinion is because I think that Ballantyne came from a family that almost everybody knew and respected. And I have to think that that somehow had factored into why they only charged him for, you know, differently than Rocky. And Rocky, who was not from there, and I believe they probably thought they could get a conviction of the capital murder against him because nobody really knew him, likely is why they changed it. That's just my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's arbitrariness right there. You see in the charging decision, same facts, basically. I can't imagine in the cases against Ballantyne, the case against Myers, there's any factual difference that would account for escalating the penalty.
Right.
Yeah, nothing in the facts changes. In fact, we mentioned in the episode how these various witnesses like Butch Madden and Roadrunner, when they changed their story, a lot of what they said was just take Anthony Corbett's Ballantyne out of my first police statement and insert Rocky Myers. Like, there's nothing new that changed. It was just essentially we implicated one person. That was a lie. It's actually this other person. There was nothing new that arose that you would make you think, oh, well, this was a worse crime or a more heinous crime than we initially thought.
Well, what was the basis under Alabama law for charging in this capital case? Is it because it was a robbery or because it was a double attack?
Yeah, both of those would be aggravating circumstances, right? That it was a murder committed during the course of a burglary as well as injuring the second victim in the case.
Now, the second victim, tell me about her. Like, what is her testimony at trial again? Does she identify Rocky?
She does not. So her statement is she is in the bedroom and she sort of hears the interaction between Ludie Mae Tucker and this assailant who is trying to get into the home. And she remains in the bedroom. She actually says she froze. She didn't come forward and it was dark in that room. And so then that person eventually runs to the back bedroom and stabs her. But she says all she can really see is that he's wearing this white shirt. She's not able to get a look at his face.
Did she say how he knew she was there?
Well, the thing is, so Ludie Mae Tucker, when she's talking to this man who enters, says, my husband is in the back bedroom, ostensibly to try to scare him off and get him to leave. She's lying because she's a widow. Her husband has passed away, but she does point back there and say, my husband is back there. So presumably the perpetrator here, when he hears that, thinks, let's leave no victim alive, and then stabs the person in that bedroom.
And the ICE story, how did that not come out before for trial? Did no one think to ask her about that?
Yeah, Sarah, do you know what happened at trial as to why that was never asked and didn't come up until after trial?
Well, my hunch is, so typically in the course of my experience here now, you know, working on many cases, oftentimes the victims are kept separate from the defense. And, you know, so my hunch is like that was never asked of her at all from the defense, because typically they don't have access to talking to victims' families. You know, the victims' families are in with the DAs and, you know, in the victims' advocates that are, you know, working with them and, you know, helping them in what they believe needs to happen, a conviction and, you know, closure by getting a conviction, you know, that kind of stuff. So typically we're shielded as defense from victims. So that's why it wasn't really discussed or brought up. Obviously in post-conviction and after the fact, we do make attempts to interview and speak with, you know, surviving victims, or in this case, it was a surviving victim, but also even the victim's family, you know, to ask questions and, you know, provide them with information.
Okay, look, we need to talk about something that nobody likes to talk about, but believe me, millions and millions of us have to deal with all the time. And I'm talking about abdominal issues, like pain, bloating, constipation. Now, you'll tell yourself it's not that bad, take some laxatives, modify your diet, exercise, but you know, you got to think about it all the time. It's frustrating. It impacts your every day. You find yourself making up excuses. Excuses not to go out because you don't want to leave home, or excuses not to eat at a particular restaurant or not eat some particular food because of your abdominal issues. And despite your best efforts to feel better, well, your symptoms just keep coming back. If it feels way too relatable, just know that you're not alone. If your gut symptoms return again and again and again and you don't know why, maybe it's time to seek help. Like 13 million others, you might actually have a real medical condition called irritable bowel syndrome with constipation, or IBS-C. If you want to get more information about your symptoms and IBS-C, all you got to do is go to ohmygut.info/podcast. That's ohmygut, ohmygut.info/podcast. And there you're going to learn about constipation, abdominal pain, and bloating. And if you're ready, you can find out ways to talk to your doctor or access one online. Once again, that's ohmygut.info/podcast. ohmygut.info/podcast to find out more.
Yeah, and Susan, I spoke with one of the attorneys who represented Rocky at trial, and I asked him that question as well as other questions about their trial preparation. And we'll hear some of the audio in episode 3. Essentially, he didn't really want to talk about the facts of the case or their preparation. The point he wanted to drive home, which Sarah alluded to a minute ago, was simply, we saved him from the death penalty and that judge overrode us, and just angry about that. But he didn't really want to answer questions about what they did or didn't do in preparation for the trial or during that trial.
Well, I guess I'm even asking less about the defense, because the prosecution, even if she did not, that the witness didn't, the victim didn't get a good look at the man, wouldn't you at least try and see if she could recognize his voice? Or at least ask about your, well, one of your lead suspects?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where they always say, as defense counsel, you're not usually supposed to ask questions you don't know the answer to. But it's tough to see how an answer here could have really... Well, it's tough to see how an answer would have hurt the defense. In other words...
I'm saying, how could the cops never ask this question of her?
Oh, right. Yeah, it's... I'm not sure why the police didn't get into detail about, well, they asked her, you know, could you identify him, a description, and she said, yeah, no, I didn't get a good look at him, but in terms of his voice, she certainly said she heard what he had to say, so you think they would have tried to make some type of vocal identification in the case.
So they never come out the other way and say, hey, here's our suspect, either Cool Breeze or Rocky, and say, does this possibly match what you remember, or do you know them, or anything like that? They never, ever ask that?
No, because she gives her police statement before Ballantyne really becomes implicated, and in a trial they never ask. So again, the documentation in this case is lacking. We're not sure that most of the things in this case that were done are recorded, but at least in terms of what's recorded, all we have is what she told police that night, her police statement she makes a couple days later, which again is before Ballantyne is arrested, and then her trial testimony, and nothing about any of that is in the record.
Now, as for this reward that was talked about in this episode, did we have any information on if and when it was paid out?
Yeah, Sarah, I asked Casey and you about this, right? And you said that you thought that it had been paid out, but you didn't have anything conclusive at this point. Is that right?
We don't. So there was definitely like people that we chatted with and talked with and over the course of this that indicated that the reward was paid, but we don't have a document to say that or, you know, prove that. So, you know, which again, like that, it should be in a file, and it's not, you know, so it also begs the question, like, as you were saying, there's so many documents that were not provided to defense, you know, but we did hear that it was paid, but we don't have proof that it was.
Yeah. And the question here is, I might make an attempt to get that information from the state of Alabama. The question I almost have, though, Sarah and Susan, is like, yeah, there's not really a witness in this case who's essentially incriminating. In other words, Rocky Myers admits to selling this VCR at the Schott House, and mainly the witnesses are just saying, we saw him sell the VCR. You know, Tyrone Elliott does say, I kind of saw him with the VCR in the area of the murder. But again, that's not too inconsistent with what Rocky says. So there's not really that witness there that you say, oh, well, if we could impeach them by showing they got the reward, that's really going to hurt the state's case, because no one really adds anything to the state's case beyond what we already sort of know. The question is simply, did Rocky find this VCR in the alley, or did he take it when he was killing the victim?
So there's a man on death row, but not a witness who is good enough to even warrant getting the award, or presumably good enough.
The other thing that I would point out as it relates to, you know, Rocky's admission that he found a VCR and traded it, you know, at the shot house for a crack, is that the interview with him was, you know, longer, you know, it was like 30 plus days after the murder. And there were things found often in that alley that runs, you know, behind his house into the shot house, you know, that he had traded in at other times. So I understand in his belief in what he recalls is that he traded a VCR in at the shot house and tied it to that day, you know, the day of the murder. But I would say, I mean, this was a person who was using crack, who's intellectually disabled, and admitted that. But I feel like it could have been a week or three or four before or after, because even in when we did the documentary and we were up there recording in the alleyway, there was all sorts of items all over that alleyway. TVs, there was all sorts of stuff, you know, so stuff just gets dumped there. And I understand he said it was the night of the murder, but I don't even know if that's accurate.
So we know for sure that Ludie Mae Tucker's VCR ended up at the shot house.
Yes.
And we know it ended up there that night. When did they find it again? They found it shortly thereafter, next day, that day?
The next day. Yeah, the next day, Percy Yarbrough had gone over and had been given a VCR in a bag that he then brought to the police. And then records, repair records for Ludie Mae Tucker's VCR showed that this was the same VCR that was in the house.
So it's definitely the same VCR, but I'm like a little bit surprised there wasn't noticeable blood on it. It's hard to see how someone could commit a crime like that and then grab a VCR.
One thing that I, you know, Sarah, that I wonder about in this whole timeline, and it's, of course, the victims are in a stressful situation. They might not remember things that correctly, but, you know, the way that Mamie Dutton describes it, it's sort of Ludie Mae Tucker gets stabbed, and then the man immediately runs to the bedroom, stabs her, and then runs out. And I know the VCR was sort of right there in the front of the house, but I struggle to figure out exactly when this perpetrator would have taken the VCR. And like, is it in his arm when he's stabbing Mamie Dutton, or does he grab it afterwards? Or it is sort of a confusing sequence of events how that perpetrator gets that VCR.
Yeah, I would agree with that as well. And it's also, for me, like, beg the question, like, was it just one person, two people, you know, that's at that door? You know, one grabs something and the other does the stabbing.
Dumb question, but was it like ripped out of, were the wires carefully unscrewed? Because those old school VCRs were a pain in the butt.
I think it was that it was just like it was ripped out.
Okay.
It was definitely ripped out.
Yeah. Just ripped out, like just pulled is all.
So no time to carefully unscrew it and all that.
No.
Were there reports of any other victims of not murders, but of simpler robberies, like door knock, smash and grabs? Or is this a sort of one-off one?
I can't respond to that.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but there's another interesting fact, which I didn't include in the podcast, but at least I think bears mentioning, and that is Keith Russell, the trial investigator, said in his investigation, it turned out that Ludie Mae Tucker was actually sort of running a pawn shop out of her house. Sarah, do you know exactly what he found in that regard?
Didn't see that coming.
Yeah, I can say that after the fact, you know, after we've been on the case for some time and we had some time to chat with Keith Russell and, you know, learn that from him. But also when I was in the field working to talk to people and, you know, get information, other people said that too, that they had pawned stuff or that they had heard that she did, you know, just kind of make some money that way by keeping stuff for people and stuff. I don't have proof of any of that, but I know that that's what was talked about.
Right. Yeah, and it seemed to me that this was more sort of someone who's just grabbing the VCR. They're not grabbing a whole bunch of stuff from the house, that it wouldn't be necessarily, they knew it was used as a pawn shop, and therefore that's why they targeted it. But it's at least something that's interesting to consider, whether the person who committed this crime knew it was a pawn shop, and at least that was part of the motivation for the crime.
Mm-hmm. And it was, so I know there's like repair records showing it was her VCR, but was it definitely hers, like she bought it, or just one she'd had before previously?
She had taken it into a repair shop. Okay. So that's how, yeah.
Yeah, some other person who had owned the VCR before had sold it to her somewhat recently, and then she told the person who sold it to her it was having problems, and he said, oh, it's still under warranty, and that's when they took it in for repairs. So, yeah, it was something that relatively contemporaneously was clear that she had and taken in under this warranty to get repairs.
America has fallen in love with Best Fiends, the 5-star rated mobile puzzle game. Discover the world of Minutia and its cute, courageous inhabitants in this fiendishly fun, free-to-download puzzle adventure. Now, I've only started playing Best Fiends this week, but I can already say it's addictive. I'm up to level 3, the Tempest Cave level, and the game is a great combination of battle games and puzzle games. With Best Fiends, you get a totally different puzzle experience. Solve thousands of fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. An epic storyline will keep you engaged with the world of Minutia. There's thousands of hours of gameplay. It's easy to learn, but difficult to master. There are thousands of levels to challenge, and you can challenge your brain with fiendish puzzles that require strategy to succeed. It's the perfect casual game to play alone or with family and friends. Best Fiends is the game to play. It's 5-star rated on the Apple App Store and Google Play, and there are over 90 million downloads globally. You can play offline anywhere, perfectly want to squeeze in another level on the go. So don't miss out on this must-play game of the year. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. Play today.
Sarah, I have a question, and that is, you know, in episode 2, we talked a lot about this document, the Tucker murder chronology, and just the lack of documentation by the Decatur police in this case. So they say at trial, Tyrone Elliott came forward much earlier than is reflected in any of the discovery documents. We know that Sergeant Boyd specifically says in the chronology, I didn't take written statements from Marzell Ewing, Butch Madden, and Roadrunner until 2 weeks after October 28th. We have no date in the police interview for Rita Hood, who is a pretty important witness who sees Cool Breeze on the night of the murder. So, you know, as an investigator and someone who's been an investigator for many years, what's your take on this lack of documentation by the Decatur police? Do you think this is just bad note-taking? Do you think it's an intentional attempt to hide information from the defense, or sort of what's going on here?
Mm-hmm. I would say it could potentially be a combination of both, because both can actually happen. But what's important about it, about this information, is that it was in fact kept, you know, from the defense. You know, we were lucky to find out the things that we found out as it related to, you know, the switching of, you know, any of the statements by several of the witnesses. You know, it frustrates me because it also makes me think, like, what else was hidden from the defense that we weren't lucky enough to find out about, or to run into somebody that could give us additional information. I mean, we really were lucky for a lot of that. And I think it does, you know, speak to that something shady and some kind of corruption was going on. There's no doubt that Butch Madden was a CI. I mean, he was a confidential informant, you know, both in, you know, like local and federal cases in that area. You know, so when you're talking about Butch Madden, you know, Roadrunner, Ewing, all of that, Tyrone Elliott, like, coming forward, and even with, you know, the fact, I mean, how he came forward as it related to, it came from Ballantyne's family hiring a private investigator, and Tyrone Elliott worked for Ballantyne's father. So then there's this investigation that's private and going on by somebody who is working for Ballantyne that ends up you know, having interviews with folks that none of the interviews that they did with any of the witnesses that Ballantyne's PI interviewed, none of that shared with the defense. So there's not any opportunity for defense attorneys to, and even the investigator, to look at the statements, you know, compare them, see if there's anything out of line that could, you know, help them to do investigation and, you know, find out what's true, what isn't true. Like they couldn't do any fact finding because they didn't have the information.
So in episode 2, we also hear about Marzell Ewing and his claim that there was a stolen car issue from Tennessee, I believe, that disappeared. Is there any documentation ever that's been found related to that?
There is documentation of that. So we ended up getting some records out of Tennessee about the stolen car, and you know, we have case files on that, and I'm trying to remember exactly. I apologize for this. I mean, I worked the case for 15 years and have a lot of different avenues that we've investigated. I also believe that the victim of the whose car was stolen wanted to have, you know, he did want to like have an arrest, like a charge against, and he was the victim in the case, but that didn't happen. And I can only imagine what they told him about here's, you know, when he got the car back. I have no idea.
Yeah, because basically, yeah, we have the notes from the Nashville police officer, and he says, I spoke to Sergeant Boyd down in Decatur. We have the two suspects. They've been arrested. You know, one's been arrested with a vehicle, and says the victim wants to prosecute, wants these men to be arrested. And then, yeah, I mean, it's clear they never were. And so, yeah, what they actually told the victim, I don't know what story they must have told to satisfy him.
Mm-hmm. Do you have his name, the victim?
I'm pretty certain we do have the report on that. So, my recollection is that we did attempt to locate him and interview him, and we weren't successful with that because that was one of our goals, but it didn't happen. So, but we do have the name. It's in the documents.
Sarah, you've been covering this case for 15 years. Is there anything else that you think listeners should know about Rocky and the case?
You know, yes, I want to say a few things just as it relates to working on his case. At times, it's been frustrating for me. When I got his case, it was one of the first cases I had worked on, and I would say that I was naive, quite a bit naive at the time, you know, because I thought that I understood that the criminal justice system has a lot of problems. I just didn't understand the extent of it. And what's fascinating to me as I have worked on cases, and especially on Rocky's case, for example, it was, as a clinical social worker, it was obvious to me of, you know, Rocky's cognitive difficulties and, you know, that he was ID. And when we were trying to get the documents, get the proof to, you know, show the courts that, you know, he shouldn't be executed because he's ID, and there's a Supreme Court case that relates to that, Atkins. And in our effort to try to prove that, I was in New Jersey a lot because that's where he grew up. I had been to the Orange County, you know, school system many times trying to get documents to show that he was in ID classes, special education, all of that stuff, and ended up just happened upon two women in the special education department who offered to help me try to find records because they had a warehouse, and it was going to be they went on their time off. It was a Saturday. They met me at this warehouse. We open up the building. There was literally filing cabinets just thrown all over the place, on top of each other, whatever, drawers falling out of some of them. One of those women ended up finding Rocky's records. And it was
just by chance.
And it was such an emotional, like, high for us, because they both started crying. At the time, the attorney I was working with, it wasn't Casey Keaton, it was another attorney at the time. I mean, and we were ecstatic, because it's like, oh, here we have it, right? Like, I just figured it was like a done deal. Like, we had the school records that showed his, you know, diagnoses and all of that. And then to continue to work on the case and realize, no, we weren't able to, we didn't win showing that he was intellectually disabled. Now, it was a different type of hearing. It wasn't a true Atkins hearing to try to prove that, but still, like I said, I was naive, and that was just like, it was such a bummer, you know, and it was just devastating. It was terrible that it didn't work that way. I mean, now years later, like, nothing surprises me now, I'm sad to say, you know, but I want to also point out that, so that makes this work difficult, right? I mean, it's difficult to work in a system that is almost impossible to win or gain anything, you know, for our clients, right? So I've, as a clinical social worker, like, I've redefined what a win looks like in a different way. So this is the point of what I'm trying to get to as far as, like, talking about Rocky and why this is important. Rocky's out of court, as I mentioned, so he's in the clemency stage. Rocky did not want us, his legal team, to ask the governor to commute his sentence. Rocky is a really kind, great guy. He's accepted and has managed his fate fairly well, you know, being on death row. But he didn't want to ask, and he didn't want to beg for his life. He didn't want to do that at all. And, you know, as far as Rocky's case is concerned, it points out so many of the issues that are, you know, just wrong and unjust about the death penalty. So we told Rocky, you don't have to beg for your life. We're going to do that for you. Like, and he still didn't want to do it. But then we explained to him, you've got issues as it relates to, you know, intellectual disability. You were a jury override. Your attorney dropped your case. You are procedurally barred. You're innocent of the crime. You know, we need to talk about these things so that in the future we can hope that this will make a difference for somebody else. So somebody else who's on death row. Like, I think that people who have a belief in capital punishment and have a belief in that people should be executed, they revolve that around the fact that, like, it should be a crime that's, you know, horrible, heinous crime. It should be, you know, no doubt of guilt or innocence, right? All of those things. So, you know, I think that when people have information about his ID, his case was dropped, it was a jury override, there was all this, you know, shady stuff that happened, people are not in favor of the death penalty in situations like this, even if they're typically would be, like, pro-death penalty, in other words. So I think it's important, because when I talk to people who have that opinion and I say, well, listen to this case or listen to, you know, what happened to, you know, Rocky Myers, they're appalled and they don't agree with it. And so I think it's important to inform and educate people about what indeed is happening. And certainly in America, but specifically, at least in, you know, Alabama, when we're talking about who and why we're executing people. And Rocky said, okay, if this can help somebody else, I'll let you guys do it. That's the type of person he is.
Any 30 days now, the clock could start ticking.
It could.
Well, Colin, this week we had another update in another capital case we've covered on Undisclosed. Can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, and this is, you know, it has some parallels to what Sarah just mentioned with the Rocky Myers case. This is the case of Charles Ray Finch, who goes by Ray Finch. He was arrested in 1976 for a murder in a country store in North Carolina. And like Rocky Myers, he was time barred. His federal appeals were out. He was out of court, as Sarah mentioned. And yet he's that one miracle that happens in these cases. He is now the 166th individual who has been exonerated from death row. Basically what happened in his case was, as noted, he was time barred. He couldn't bring a claim for relief in federal court, but there is this, as we've mentioned before, this schlup bootstrap that says if you have evidence of actual innocence, you can get back into federal court. And what he was able to show was there were essentially two witnesses in this case. One was the clerk at the country store, and he had picked Charles Ray Finch out of a lineup. However, it was found that was a suggestive lineup, that he had said in his statement the person who committed this crime had on a three-quarter length coat or jacket, and Mr. Finch was the only one in the lineup who was wearing a jacket, and so that was found to be suggestive. There's also some questions about the firearm that was used in the crime. And then there's another individual who said he saw Charles Ray Finch outside the country store. His name was Noble Harris. And again, similar to some of the facts here in the Rocky Myers case, he had expressed doubt to the police in North Carolina as to whether, in fact, he had seen Charles Ray Finch outside the store on the day of the murder. That was not turned over. And so the Fourth Circuit a few months ago, this is when we covered the case in Undisclosed, had found he established actual innocence, sent the case back down to federal district court, and that federal district court said, we don't have enough evidence to convict him now that you've sort of torn apart these two witnesses. And so they dropped the case. And then just earlier this week, the prosecutor's office said, we're dropping this case. We can't take it to trial. And so 43 years after he was initially arrested in 2019 now, Charles Ray Finch, 166th person exonerated from death row. So he's one of those rare success stories that we see, but also 166 examples of people who are on death row, some of them hours away from being executed, have now been proven actually innocent.
Now, if only that's a sign of hope in Rocky's case.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Sarah, this week. And we'll be back next week with episode 3 on Rocky's case. And Colin, anything else to add?
I think that's it for now, although we might have found, as I said at the end of episode 2, the smoking gun. So listeners, episode 3 will have what I believe is the strongest evidence of Rocky's innocence. And hopefully that, along with some other evidence, might move the needle for the governor or potentially get him back into court.
All right. We're back on Monday with episode 3.
Thanks so much for listening to this special addendum episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, and Mital Telhan, our executive producer. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @UndisclosedPod.